Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, I'm Sophie Ellis-Bextor, and welcome to Spinning Plates, the podcast where I speak to busy working women who also happen to be mothers about how they make it work. I'm a singer, and I've released 7 albums in between having my 5 sons, aged 16 months to 16 years, so I spin a few plates myself. Being a mother can be the most amazing thing, but can also be hard to find time for yourself and your own ambitions. I want to be a bit nosy and see how other people balance everything. Welcome to Spinning Plates. Hello, how are you doing? So, welcome to my second episode, my second podcast episode. Thanks for all the feedback with the first one. That was really lovely, and I'm so excited to finally get it up and out in the world because, it's an exciting, nice project, and I'm glad it's finally out there for you to have a listen, see what you think. So, this week's guest is the wonderful Caitlin Moran. We had a lovely, lovely chat in an actual pod. So it's good to do a podcast in a pod. She has a beautiful garden pod. She has a beautiful garden. During lockdown, she's made her garden even more insect-friendly, she said. So we were surrounded by constant buzzing of little bees and birds flying over while we were sat there in her garden pod. We spoke about lots and lots of stuff. Caitlin and I first met, she actually did my first ever interview when I was, I think, 17, 18, something like that. I remember we got on really well. So I've sort of bumped into her lots of times over the years, and it was lovely to talk to her. All things work and parenthood, and she is a fountain of knowledge and wisdom. In fact, she helped me get through lockdown with an article she wrote for The Times all about homeschooling, and it basically said, don't expect to be good at homeschooling if you never set out to homeschool, which I took as good reason just to not really homeschool at all throughout lockdown. So thanks for that, Caitlin. What do you need to know about for this interview if you've got small people around? Small ears won't like. There's one mention of what my kids call the sure word. There is one mention of the rude word for boobs that starts with a T. And I think we start off the chat talking quite a lot about alcohol. It just popped up, and it is by no means two women endorsing the large consumption of alcohol at all. This is not an advert for booze. It just came up in conversation. Pretty sure I'm supposed to do that kind of responsible disclaimer. Anyway, I'm going to stop blabbering now. I'm going to go make myself a cup of tea while we have a listen. And thanks once again for joining me on Spinning Plates. And here's Caitlin and I talking in the pod. Enjoy. So, first of all, I should probably say where we are, because it's a slightly different sound, and we are literally in a pod.
Yes, it's a pod. It's a literal podcast.
Yeah, we're
so pleasing.
Wanted to make sure I could find a pod, and you're the first place that had a pod. This is beautiful. We're in your garden, your gorgeous garden that you've been tending throughout lockdown.
Yes, this has been the thing that's kept me from going nuts. I felt so sorry for everyone who doesn't have a garden, because when things were stressful in the early days, just coming out here and shifting huge amounts of earth from one side of the garden to the other is the kind of sweaty physical stuff that you need to do when the world seems crazy.
Definitely. And actually, we had that bizarre constant gorgeous weather, which felt really odd, actually, didn't it? Just unremitting, these beautiful, hardly any rain.
Yeah, suddenly we didn't have any work and it was really sunny. It was like, this isn't Britain. This isn't my life. How do I cope with this? And how I cope was with gardening. So yeah, we're in a garden that I've made insect friendly. It's full of things that attract. So if you hear a slight buzzing in the background, that's my 20,000 million bees that have now swarmed on the garden.
No, it's beautiful. It's really beautiful. And it's funny because with the weather thing that was happening in lockdown, I don't know if you found this as well, but all my usual markers throughout the year, so I know what's happening and, you know, all the things that happen, whether it be work things or planning your holidays or kids in school or whatever the things, everything just sort of went, and suddenly just had this sort of endless summer holiday type feel.
Yeah.
But it wasn't obviously really like summer holidays.
Well, all the months disappeared as well. Like, it's all just been 2020, hasn't it? Like,
I know.
Kind of like, there's no, it's all just kind of, and the weeks are just kind of like, everything's like a sort of blob, sort of every so often punctuated by either Gardener's World or Springwatch for me, or The Lion King. The week that we were watching The Lion King, that felt like a distinct week. But other than that, they've all been the same.
Well, actually, Lion King became part of our lockdown because we taught our youngest one, Mickey, who's he's now just come up to 18 months. We taught him how to say, "Ah, Zvenja," which is really satisfying on a baby. I recommend.
Yes. Do they all then pick him up and go, "Hey, Zeman"?
It has been known to happen.
If you've got a baby, that's what you have to do, isn't it?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Anyone dropped him yet, or have they?
Oh yeah, of course. He's fifth one down. Yeah, he's like, he gets the best, and he gets that sort of carefree attitude to. I think with the others, I might have been a bit more like, "Don't hold him like that." But now I'm just sort of used to the fact that the 11-year-old would hoik him under his arm. And
well, you know, they're
the
quite difficult to break. I remember with our fifth son, the eldest debate, like kind of like by that point, we've all established that it does take quite a lot to even end up in A&E, let alone for them to die. So we do stair tobogganing, where you put a child in a washing basket and push it down the stairs. We do a thing called throw you out the window, where you just grab a child and go, "I'm going to throw you out the window," and you kind of hurl them towards the window and catch them at the last minute. And now I'm a parent. The one that I kind of regret the most in terms of my parents' heart health was we would dress, we had these life-size baby dolls, and we would dress them in the youngest child's clothes. And then we'd wait till our parents were in the front room watching TV, and then we'd drop them out the bedroom window so they'd just see what looked like their youngest child in its clothes just hurtle past the window and land on the ground. And we'd scream as it was happening. And it took them about...
Absolutely awful.
Isn't that evil? Now I'm a parent. I want to apologise to my parents. That was a wrong... I know now that was a wrong thing to do, but at the time we didn't have a TV and we were just making our own amusement, man.
Yeah, that's just so fun. That level of shock with your parents is just the best.
Oh, they looked so scared. It was hilarious. They looked genuinely terrified.
Did you genuinely do that more than once?
Oh, frequently. And then... Because that was with the... So we'd invented that for the fifth. So by the time we had the eighth, that was a very regular occurrence. By the end, they didn't even look up. They'd just be like, "Oh, baby's falling past the window. Fine."
Yeah, I'd be that doll again.
Yeah.
Probably.
Yeah, I hope. 90% chances.
So when I was thinking about yesterday and meeting you today, I stumbled across a YouTube clip with you where you're doing a book tour for How to Build a Girl. And you come out on stage and say, "Oh, normally on these book tours, someone interviews me, but I've just found out backstage that no one's interviewing me, so I'm going to interview myself." So it did occur to me I could probably just sort of tell you roughly what the podcast I've been doing is about, and then just...
I am self-interviewing. I'm very aware, like... I can provide an enormous amount of content. I'm a very chatty person. I've already had two cups of coffee and I've got my vape on the go. But I'm also aware that I will just talk and talk and talk and not stop. So you'll see me every so often go, "Okay, you have now been talking for 7 minutes solidly and you haven't breathed in. Stop counting. Just take a breath and let Sophie say something." So be aware of that dynamic. If you need to put a hand up and just go, "Dude,
okay,
please.
That'll be the sign.
You've delighted me enough."
This is wonderful, that. Well, actually, what I liked is when you started interviewing yourself, your second question was, "Are you good in bed?" So do you remember that?
No, I don't. I remember there was... Was it in America? There was one in Philadelphia where
you said
I turned
you were quite
up.
Hungover.
I was so hungover because I'd been in New York the night before. Yeah, I turned up in Philadelphia and they just went, and I was like, "So who's the guy who's interviewing me?" And they were like, "Oh, there isn't anyone." So I quickly had to, I think I put a load of questions in a hat and pulled them out. I can't remember. But yeah, I was in one of those shuddering hangovers. I've noticed, so I'm 45 now. I've noticed, the next book that I've written that's coming out in September is called More Than a Woman, which is the sequel to How to Be a Woman, which is about middle age. I was like, we don't talk about middle age and feminism in middle age and how the sort of whole game changes. And one of the things they don't tell you about middle age is that you can't drink anymore. Like, wine becomes your enemy. It will destroy you. And we literally stop producing the enzymes that we need in our stomach to break down alcohol. So what you thought was a hangover in your 20s and 30s, in your 40s you realise was but a mere bagatelle. These are things that last 3 days, and it's like you're standing at the top of a multi-storey car park staring down at this hangover going, "I'm not going to be able to get down. I'm going to be up here at this level of anxiety and pain for the rest of my life."
So I'm 41. When does that sort of...
Well, have you noticed it yet? Now? Like, how are your hangovers?
I'm generally one of those people that gets away with it quite well, I think. But I can't, obviously I can. I haven't really had many hangovers recently, obviously, because of lockdown. There's not been that much going on. I think the closest we came to it was after one of the kitchen discos, and we sort of pushed it a bit more with a couple of cocktails and sat in the garden. But no, really, I don't really get bad hangovers that much.
Are you a wise drinker, though? Can you sip on a cocktail for half an hour like a lovely lady and then maybe have a glass of water?
No, I feel like I'm quite reckless.
Really?
Actually.
You beast. Because I'm very much like all aboard the booze train. Like as soon as I've had one, I'm like, and now we're on a ship and we go to Valhalla and we will not stop till the morning. And the idea of stopping seems like the death of all fun. So
yeah.
So yeah, I've realised you just can't do that when you're in your 40s.
I think I've married someone more like that. Do you find you drink dark spirits and that kind of thing? Because that's definitely worse, isn't it? I don't really drink that.
Cider is my drink.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, it's my working class, my days in Volvo, like kind of it would be cider. That's an exciting drink. It's like champagne, but for the pavement champagne. Cider is my drink of choice. But yeah, if I have more than one of them now, it's hell. So I generally don't bother now.
Cider was definitely the first thing I ever got drunk on when I was a teenager. I remember that very well. I remember because I didn't get drunk till I was 15.
Yes.
And a lot of my friends had been drunk loads of times before that and been drinking, and I was always like, I'm not drinking. And I remember having it and then being like, this is amazing.
It's tasty booze.
Yeah, why did I ever not want to do this?
Kiddie booze. Well, you came around because you were sort of, we were teenagers at the same time. Yeah. They invented alcoholic lemonade.
I know, how weird is that? Two Dogs and Hooch and
yes,
all that.
Yes, I know. And it was like, wow, they're really facilitating children drinking. Britpop is about kids getting drunk and it not being disgusting. That was a very reckless move on behalf of the alcohol industry.
Really reckless. That's so, I know, what a weird thing to experience at the same time. It's such a sort of standard thing, getting your little alco pop.
Have you found that with boozes that once you've been sick on them, you can't drink them again? Because I started off on Southern Comfort and lemonade, and once you've been sick on it, particularly if you've been sick through your nose, then you can't go back to that booze.
Oh, yeah, that's the end of that. Yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely.
So then you have to move on. And I think that's why when you look in a bar, there are so many different drinks.
Yeah.
And they invent so many cocktails.
Have you been sick on this?
Literally that. Just kind of like, you're just like, I've done all of that third of the bar. I've been sick on all of those, so now I'm into the middle section of the bar. Show me your rums.
The same with food, though, isn't it? If you have food poisoning from food, you can't eat that again.
Still can't eat salt and vinegar crisps.
Really?
Yeah, that was a bad day.
With your lockdown, how's it all been? What's going on in your life at the moment, aside from your beautiful garden? You've been here with your girls throughout the whole thing.
Yeah, my husband, the girls, and the dog. Always useful to have a dog during some kind of national crisis, I find, because they just have no idea what's going on.
Yeah.
They're just like, everything's great. In fact, did you see that story about there was a dachshund that they had to take to the vet because it had stopped wagging and they were really worried, and then they realised that it had stopped wagging because its tail had broken, because it was so happy that everybody was at home all the time that it had been wagging so much its tail broke.
I didn't even know that was a thing.
Me neither.
Aww.
But that's how happy dogs are to be with people. They just love the guys. No, it's been, I mean, to be fair, I work from home. I'm a writer and I work from home. So my life has been literally exactly the same as it was before. I just spend all day in my office writing, and then I take the dog for a walk for an hour. With the pandemic, with a mask. Before the pandemic, without a mask. And that's the only difference, really. And I like a mask. I still suffer from adult hormonal acne around my chin. So for me, the mask has been a godsend. I'm just like, great, I don't have to put foundation on. Just pop the mask on, make my eyes pop. That's all I need to bother with. As long as you've got the mascara on, you can... it's been a blessing.
And you've got two teenage daughters. How have they been finding everything?
Again, I'm so... I mean, all my friends that have got younger kids, like, and I can't even look at you because you have five and they're all so small. I can't even begin to imagine with homeschooling on top of that. That's brutal. But if you've got two teenagers, like kind of, they've just been off amusing themselves. They've both been at Brit school, the oldest one doing film, the youngest one doing music. So the oldest one's just been making films around the house. She's done one about, that she's editing now, about trying to have your prom during lockdown, which is just such a great idea. Everyone's on Zoom trying to have a prom, because otherwise they won't have one. And the youngest one's recorded a single and an album, so they've just kept themselves busy in their rooms. It's been heaven.
That's amazing.
And I finally taught them how to do housework.
Well done. I think I would have found that more of a success than if I'd managed to be good at homeschooling, to be honest. I think that would have been, I would have been very happy with that.
How's homeschooling been then?
Well, actually, you really saved me, I think, because you wrote an article really early on in lockdown about homeschooling, and not only did it really help me, but I kept sending it to everybody I knew that was stressing about it.
Oh.
Because you said so many things that made me feel better, and actually a lot of it really worked out, by the way, so well done.
Uh-huh.
So
hey, I was right, that's good.
You were right, because you basically said a lot of the... I started off the homeschooling in earnest.
Yes.
Box files, each one, you know, each child had a box file for their work, we had all the laptops set up with all the logins, it was going to be great, we were going to start in the morning, do a little bit, then 15-minute break, then blah, blah, blah.
Ooh, so wholesome and scheduly.
I know, but also probably... I was quite terrified because everything had just suddenly gone whoomph, you know, you're home now, go for it, good luck. And so the wheels probably fell off of about maybe day two or three.
I'm surprised it was that long.
Yeah, five. No, looking back.
Hour one, I would have thought, with five.
Well, yeah, because Hardy and the kids found it easy to work, be self-motivated to work. My eldest is 16. Mm-hmm. He doesn't really like school. So he's like, great, now I don't really have to do it. And I go, are you doing it? He goes, yes, I don't know. And he probably wasn't. Next one down, 11, very cross about the whole thing and couldn't really work independently. Always wanted me to help him work out what was going on where. The eight-year-old was just quite freaked out, really. I think he just thought, I don't know really what I'm doing, and all my friends are probably doing it, so I'd rather not do anything because I feel terrible about, you know, failing. And then the four-year-old just wanted to do other stuff, play Play-Doh, do fun things. And then the baby's just there, like, wanted to be picked up. So I was just like, this is untenable, really. And in your article, you spoke about if you're the sort of parent that's ever sort of slagged off school or teachers or anything, how are they going to expect you to suddenly be like, hello, I'm your teacher?
Totally. When you're just sitting there just going, well, the curriculum is just a complete construct. It doesn't actually teach you how to learn, and it's all just balls. Yeah, that's the... Yeah, if you've been one of those rogue parents who's just like, hey, what even is school? Like, let's just deep that for a minute. Yeah, you're screwed because they're just like, well, I don't believe in education. But I wrote that piece because my parents home educated us, and everyone was so scared of home education. I think they thought that it's got to be the box files and the schedules and you've got to do teaching.
Yeah.
And what we learned from being home educated is that it's most of when you're going to a formal school, it's just crowd management. Like, you can... Well, my daughter was really ill a couple of years ago, so she had 6 months off school, and we got her 2 hours of tutoring a week. That was it for 6 months. And when she went back to school, she was ahead of everybody else in her class.
Wow.
Because so much of it is just crowd management and, like, kind of like, you know, catering to all the kids in the room. The actual amount of learning you need to do in a week is minimal. And then once you get beyond the idea of lessons, like, kind of when you're home educated, you go through this process, they call it de-schooling, where for the first 6 months you won't want to do anything. You're like, I'm free, it's a holiday forever, hurrah, and you don't want to learn anything. But then around about 6 months, you just get bored and you want to start learning because kids just want to learn. Like, that is the young of every creature is just a curiosity machine. They just want to poke things with sticks and learn how things work and ask questions and why is the sky blue and what happens if I go over here and what if I mix this with this? They want to learn things. And if you just let them get on with it, they will just follow their passions. You know, they'll soon... They won't bother with stuff they don't like. But, like, do you need to bother with stuff you don't like? If you hate it when you're eight...
Yeah.
It's unlikely to be your job in the future.
Yeah.
So why spend all this time becoming mediocre at something you loathe and which you won't ever do again after the age of 16 when you could just put all of your time and attention into your passions, which is probably what you will end up doing as a job if things work out well. So, yeah, so kids will just teach themselves. You just have to have the confidence to sit back and go... And whenever they come to you and go, I'm bored, just go, well, there's some housework that needs doing. And then they will just scuttle off and sort themselves out.
So. No, I literally did do all of that.
Yes.
So, yeah, when they went, I'm bored, I'm like, great, well, here's some soapy water and here's a cloth and here are the cupboard doors and they would really need a doing. And one thing you wrote as well is that nothing cures boredom like doing something you're interested in. And it's true. So, like, the 11-year-old has now been making loads of movies.
Yes.
And he wants to be a director and he started editing and putting these things... And he's passionate about it, and I think it without the lockdown thing, I don't think he would have got so into it and pushed it so far.
I mean, you don't want to be too like, it was a gift, because for a lot of people it's been terrible.
Exactly.
And, you know, economically things are going to be awful, but for a lot of people it has been. Like, we will probably never again, hopefully, touch wood, in human history have a moment where everything is put on pause and everyone is going through the same experience.
I
like
know.
That's and just all these things that you just realise we'll never have again. Like, we finally walked into the centre of London because you couldn't go on public transport, so it was 41,000 steps into the centre of London and back again to see what it was like in lockdown. And just to see it that empty, like, even if Tom Cruise shoots the world's most expensive film here, you'd never be able to empty out London in that way. It's extraordinary to see, and there were, like, sparrows nesting on the roof of Gucci and, like, kind of... And all the sounds were so different. I was trying to go, why does London sound different? And it was high heels. You couldn't hear any heels.
Yeah.
Like, kind of, you're so used to, especially if you're on New Bond Street or something, just hearing the heels.
Yeah.
All you could hear was birdsong, and all the people had gone, and you realise that a city is two things. It's the buildings, which in a lockdown you get to appreciate, you get to look at them. It's such a beautiful thing that people have invented. But it's also the people. It's like a play. It's like a film. Like, they are the actors. You're so used to seeing all these dramas and the people who've come down here and the people who need to reinvent themselves in a city, and with them gone you just see it as, like, I don't know, ancient caves or something. Like, they've emptied out, and a lot of the people who've left the city won't come back, but those buildings will be used again. Like, when I came down here in the early 90s, it was just after the recession, and, like, the St. Pancras Hotel had Budleia growing out the roof of it, and that's where the Spice Girls filmed the video for Wannabe down the stairs. It was a wreck. And we just thought, it's always going to be like this. You know, back at King's Cross was scary and completely empty, the old gasworks. And now there's a whole new city there.
Yeah, yeah.
And the St. Pancras Hotel has become a Gigi Hotel.
Like,
kind of... we'll empty out, we'll have a recession, and other people will do things with those buildings and we'll rebuild again. So, you know, it's scary, but if you just take the long view on the whole thing and go, everything is cyclical, people come, people go. Yeah. If all the rich people leave London, then it will allow people with less money to come in and reinvent it as something else again.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. It's just, I suppose it's a similar thing of thought, really, of just that confidence of just being like, just step back and don't feel you've got to have the urgency of sort of fixing things immediately, because it's out of your control. So
yeah, it's like being in the sea, isn't it, when you're surfing. I learned a lot from surfing, like, kind of like, you can learn to get up on the board. That's a technique, you can learn that, that's a skill, you can become strong. But the other 50% of surfing is just waiting for the right wave. Mm-hmm. You've just got to stand there and wait until there's a wave that you can surf. There's no point in going, I'm just going to get on my board for every wave, because most of them won't take you to the shore. So you just have to learn, you just have to wait for the right moment. You can't fight the sea. So you just have to sit there and wait for times to change.
Yeah, no, it's such a weird, extraordinary time. I sort of feel like I'm living through history books in a way. Just, I found myself catching up with some friends and writing messages back and forth, and my little text messages sounded like some sort of back of a postcard thing, you know. Yes, lockdown was this, but we're slowly emerging into that. And like, whoa, it's like some sort of like historical talk. You already sound really old-fashioned.
You sounded quite Attenborough there. Yeah. Slowly we emerge, blinking into the sunlight of post-lockdown Britain. Yes.
I wouldn't credit us with that. And I think also when, just to sort of the other side of the coin with the homeschooling and having all the kids at home, whilst, yes, there were some brilliant moments with people kind of having to do things because they were bored and thinking, right, I'm going to go. Like, my 8-year-old got back into dressing up, which is really cute. Aww. He hasn't done that for ages, and he's been different characters all the time. And that's been really good for him. But there's also been extraordinary bits of tension. And I'll find Richard and I can be really calm and then suddenly be like, something just set you off, because you're all kind of in this like slightly weird, I don't know, bubbling anxiety, I guess.
Well, that's the other thing to remember for homeschooling, like, kind of like, you are also dealing with children who are, you know, to a great or lesser extent, quite traumatised.
Yeah.
Like, kind of, so that so much of it is pastoral care of your children. Like, kind of, there's no point in trying to sit down and drill them in maths when they haven't seen their friends for months. And then when they watch the news, they're talking about thousands of people dying. Like, kind of, you just got to sit back and go, the first aid I need to apply here is my child is upset. Let's just chill and ride this a bit.
And actually, the thing that happened with your daughter when she was off school for 6 months and having the tutor, that was actually something that my mum was talking to me about with the beginning bit. She was going, look, you know, if one of your kids had broken their legs or glandular fever or something, you wouldn't be sitting there going, oh, I'm so sorry, you're never going to catch up. That's the end of that then.
Yeah.
You'd just be going, look, bide your time, pass these months, get yourself better, and then you go back to school.
But that's the great thing, it's allowed us to experience other people's lives. Like, for instance, you know, people who've got disabled kids, like, kind of like, that will be happening to them all the time. So we've all experienced that. They're often taking months out of school, so we've all got to feel that. And the other thing I've really realised, because I'm obsessed with middle age for women at the moment, because I've just written the book, is that most of the stuff that I've written about in the book is how stuff that happens in the house is invisible. We don't tell women's stories. When you're young and out and about and a hot mess and racketing around town, we have all the stories and all the TV shows and all the movies are about that. As soon as you get married and you're at home with kids, the door's shut and it's silent. We don't really have stories that come from the house and domestica and how you keep a marriage together. There are no movies about how you stay married. There are no movies about raising children. There are no movies about giving birth, which is a mad psychedelic experience. Like, this is just crazy to me. But I realise that, and then the arguments about housework and what you see and the systems that you have and the invisible labour and the second shift and all these things that we talk about in feminism. But during lockdown, everybody lived the life of a middle-aged woman. Everybody was just stuck at home. Everybody was trying to keep their relationships together. Everybody was obsessed with housework and cooking and how you just sort of do the stuff that bonds society together. So we've all had this experience, which I'm hoping that the next wave of feminism is going to address care work. You know, the people that keep society together, these stories that don't happen, sort of, that we don't hear about because they're behind closed doors. So it's been a brilliant sharing experience. We've all stepped into different lives in the last couple of months, and that's an incredible experience.
Yeah, but during that time, it's also sometimes been quite frighteningly traditional, I think. And I think for me, I don't have a place at home where I work, really. All my work has normally been somewhere I go to, and I've kept it out the house, so at home I'm quite available. And I really struggled with not having a space that was my own. And I mean, obviously, as a writer, you've been presumably writing and working from home the whole time. And so your kids, presume, have grown up always knowing that your room is your space.
Yes.
But what were they like when they were little and you're working?
Well, this is, I mean, Virginia Woolf was on this 120 years ago. If anybody listening hasn't read Virginia Woolf's A Room of One's Own, I massively recommend it. I, for years, didn't read Virginia Woolf because I thought it was going to be very sort of high 19th century stuff. It's literally like chatting to a mate. I get the same thing with her that I get with Oscar Wilde and Herman Melville, who wrote Moby Dick, that they are people stuck in the wrong century.
Yeah.
And they feel like they are writing to people in the future, going, I wish I was in the future, where it was okay to be a lesbian. lesbian, to be gay, to talk about these things. Like, I am stuck in the wrong century.
Yeah.
And I'm putting these messages in a bolt to you. So it's a brilliantly chatty book about what's the difference between being a man and a woman and working. And she's walking around the colleges in Cambridge, I think it is, and she's looking at the men's colleges where they have fine wines and fabulous dinners and these amazing rooms. And then she goes back to the one female college where the food is horrible and the wine is shit and like the rooms are tiny and they don't have the best tutors. And she just wants a room of her own, a room of one's own. She's like, every woman needs a space where she can go and shut the door and think.
Yeah.
Because the main thing, and particularly if you have children, is you don't have more than 10 minutes to be thinking about one thing before you're interrupted. Mm. And it's the constant interruption. And there's this whole thing, I've wrote about this in the book, but like in literature, there's this sort of famous thing about when Samuel Taylor Coleridge was writing Kubla Khan, that big epic poem. And it's this famous thing that halfway through he was interrupted when a man from Porlock knocked at the door and the fever dream was broken and he couldn't write the rest of the poem. And like, we all sort of mourn the fact that this poem should have been incredible, but he was interrupted by this man knocking on the door. And this is a huge thing in literature. And I'm like, the reason they make such a deal about it in literature, it's the only time a straight white man was ever interrupted whilst working.
Mm.
Like, out of every woman will have been interrupted by 50 men from Porlock. Lock a day,
yeah.
Usually shouting, Mom, where's my shoes? They're in the coat cupboard. I looked, look again, they're definitely there. Oh, yeah, they are.
Yeah,
and then that's it, your fever dream has broken. So, the female mind, I would love to see scans of it. You know, that whole thing about women having to multitask is because we have shattered brains. Like, kind of, you can't think on one track for more than 5 minutes because you are interrupted. So, our brains are shattered and kind of working on 50 things at the same time, which can be a bonus, you know.
Yeah, it can be.
In times like this, you notice, like, kind of, you know, I see that my husband just has to do one thing beginning to end,
yes,
and he can't be interrupted. Whereas,
no.
I can, you know, and I just, but most women will do this. If I'm cooking the tea, I will be chopping an onion, I will be answering an email, I'll be looking for curtains on the internet, I'll be counselling a friend on my phone who's going through a divorce, I'll be sewing up a hem, I'll be like doing my child's shoelaces up. You're doing literally 20 things at once. I was going to do a thing about this last week. I was like, if I'm sitting on the toilet, I will be cleaning as I'm sitting on the toilet. So while you're sitting there doing a wee, you can just like, oh, there's a J cloth, I'll just squirt this, wipe that while you're sitting there. Oh, there's an empty toilet roll on the floor, put that in the bin, go online, order some more toilet rolls. Like, kind of, you're literally tidying even as you wee.
Yeah.
No second is wasted.
I know. Well, that's why I wanted a podcast is called Spinning Plates, because that's literally how I feel sometimes with all these things just sort of doing all the time. And, you know, I have a lot of children, and I thought, you know, I thought, oh, brilliant, you know, they'll be more merry and big family. Actually, you'll have these five individuals and everything they do is really different, and all the things they need out of life and all the time you spend. And I mean, you grew up in a massive family, but you've now only got your two kids.
Yes.
But I think being part of a massive family is really defining. I think it's like, if you're from a big family, that's part of who you are your whole life. So are there things you've taken from being in a big family that are part of how you've raised your family, even though you're smaller?
I absolutely thought I would have, because I loved being from a big family.
Yeah, like, you're the eldest, like me as well, so baby on the hip quite often.
Literally, like kind of from 11 onwards, that was like the babies were mine. As soon as one was weaned, I got it, and then my mum would get pregnant again. So, so I felt that I knew loads about childcare. I was very confident about having kids. I got pregnant at 24, which is sort of, I was 10 years younger than everybody else. You'd like, okay, crack on with this, I know how to do it. And it fully intended, I was going to have five. I was like, eight I think is too many. But five, I was like, I think that seems like a reasonable amount. So then I had one child and I was like, might narrow that down to three. And then I had the second one, I was like, I'm done. Because just the physics of it, you've only got two hands.
Mm.
So when you're crossing a road, you've got one child in one hand, one child in the other. As soon as you've got a third, you're trying to stop it from going into the road with your foot.
Yeah.
And then the fourth, you have no feet on the ground. You're stopping them with your arms and legs. And then five, what, you're stopping them with your head when they're trying to run out the street? Like, it's... the physics don't work, man. So I loved... I mean, coming from a big family, you do feel like... it's kind of like being famous. So there were like eight of us, and if we went uptown, we had a big old battered Volkswagen Caravanette, and we'd get out the car, and everyone would stop and stare, like kind of... and like, you need to sort of call ahead if you're going to go to a cafe, because they need to clear half the room. Like, kind of like, you can't...
Yeah, a family of 10.
You can't anonymously slink through the streets. Like, you are noticeable. Like, people stare at you. And people will say things like... but why? Why are there eight of you?
Yeah.
And they presumed it was that we were Catholic, but my parents were just hippies and just sort of liked kids. They're like babies. Kind of lost interest once they got to about two. But then that was great, because then we'd just go off on our own. And we would do things like, as soon as a new baby was born, Mum would come home and be like, can we have the baby? And she would obviously go, yes, you may have this baby. Just pushed it out and would like a break. So we'd take it up the garden and we'd climb up the tree and then we'd pass the baby up the tree to the top branch and like put it on the top of the tree like the little Christmas fairy. And that was like, we were like, you're in kids gang now, you're one of us. Aww. And there'd just be a little baby at the top of the tree. Again, memories that I look back on now and go, thank God my mother didn't see that.
Yeah, she would have had a heart attack. Scary and sweet at the same time.
We were careless. I mean, we were baby droppers. That was our main profession for 10 years, just dropping babies.
But that kind of slightly scrappy round the edges thing is sort of thing I quite love about Big Family, actually. I like the slight chaos of it. And, I was nodding a lot with what you were saying because now that we are, parents to five, I feel like elephants on parade when we go out.
Yes.
And people are like, ooh, this is going to be interesting. If you sit down in a restaurant, actually, that's one thing about lockdown I loved is not having to worry about taking them out anywhere public.
Yes.
Especially when I've got a little noise, one is just, like, you know, shouty, when they get shouty.
Yeah.
So Mickey, he's gone from being like the kind of cute little bubba to now he's like, actually, no, I'm quite assertive and I've got things to say, even though I don't have the words for it. So, when we go out and about and if we go on holiday or if we're doing anything, I feel like we're like that music from Jungle Book.
And just the door opening, another one coming out, and another one coming out, and another one coming out. Just
and like also the mine are all boys and mostly redheads, so you know, quite conspicuous,
noticeable. Yeah, very much. The thing I love the most with the Big Family, whenever my family come back together, it's the cross-talking, like the chaos of it. Like when we wrote the sitcom about our family, it was so hard to write what dialogue was actually like in the Big Family, because you gain this amazing ability. You can absolutely be talking to someone, listening to what they're saying, replying to them, but aware of a conversation on the other side of the room, especially if someone's slagging you off, they think very quietly. And you'll be in the middle of the conversation with one sibling, in the middle of a sentence, and on the same breath turn and just go, I did not do that! Mum was lying! That never happened! Back to the same conversation. And you can actually talk to 10 people at the same time.
Yeah.
So I think that might be one of the reasons why I just talk so much, because I'm so used to being in a family where it's not an uninterrupted monologue. I would be talking this much, but everybody else would be talking this much, and I would be responding to what they were saying.
Yeah.
So just with one person, I swamp you and overwhelm you because I'm used to fighting against 7 other people.
That's what I'm saying. It's like a really defining thing. If you're part of a big family, and I think other people from big families will understand, like, okay, yeah, we're all part of this. And I think as well, in our experience, when I had 4, I felt like a big, small family, and 5 tipped me into feeling like a small, big family, if that makes sense.
Very much so. I guess it comes down to cars, doesn't it? You can just about fit 4 in, like, kind of like an estate car if you've got those 2 rows, but with 5, it's time for a van. That's what. The other thing, I can diagnose people who come from big families, because if you're out eating, they will eat very quickly because you're so used to someone just leaning across. If you pause for a second going, you don't want that sausage then, spearing it with a fork and eating it in front of you. So we had a system whereby as soon as the food was put on the table, and once we had 5 kids, we stopped having a table because we needed the dining room for a bedroom, so we all just ate on our laps. So everyone would come in the front room with their plates, and then you would pick your plate up and ostentatiously lick everything on it. She's going, I've licked it, so you can't have it. And there would be some bold spit people who would like, I don't care, I'll eat it with spit on anyway. But generally that protected your food from 90% of the people in the room. Just lick it. Or if you didn't have time to lick everything, you'd just do a general spit on it. Like, that's mine now. Dare you to have it. So I can always, if I go out for dinner with someone who's otherwise very sort of contained and posh and they eat really quickly, I'm like, you come from a big family, don't you? Like, yes, I do.
Have any of your siblings had lots of kids?
No, most of them were horrified by my mother's. My mum had a series of absolutely terrible births. She obviously had that very strong thing of forgetting what each birth was like quite rapidly afterwards, because they were all successively more and more awful. So they just watched her coming back from the hospital more and more trashed each time and just went, yeah, we're not going to have it. So my sister's had one, my brother's had one, and everybody else has gone, don't want kids.
Really?
Yes. Just like,
they probably thought they'd have billions of grandbabies, and actually it's been...
No. Well, the family tree is dwindling quite mightily. Yeah. I'm the majority of its branches right now. I'm the breeder. Everybody else has just gone, nah. It's a waste of time.
Yeah, well, I think that's quite common as well. I've got a friend who's 1 of 8, and all of her and siblings just had 2. They're like, we're not going to go in for that kind of madcap thing.
Have your kids said if they want to have a big family, if they did a bit of review?
My eldest is like, no, he doesn't want any kids. He loves having the babies around and he likes it, but he finds it all a bit exhausting, I think. He just finds it a bit tiring.
Well, it's so counter to your interests when you're 16, I mean, I left home on my 18th birthday because I just really felt that I had had enough of children at that point.
I was exactly the same. There's actually a lot we've got in common, because I left at 18 as well. I had young siblings and I'm 1 of 6 in my family, but not all in the same house, but the eldest by quite a long way. And especially when I started getting into music, I couldn't wait to get up because the home was still very much routine-y about the little ones' lives and then getting up early. And totally. I wanted to lie in and sleep, and I wanted to go to gigs, and I wanted nobody looking out for when I was home.
Well, it was baths for me. I'd come back from a gig, and those are the days when everybody smoked indoors. So you'd come back from a gig sort of laminated in nicotine. Like your clothes would, they'd be stiff and stink, and you'd have to put them through the wash twice for them to not smell the fags because everybody would be smoking. So I'd come back stinking, and I'd want to have a bath, but we had a very sort of clanky boiler, and if I'd run a bath, they would have woken everyone up and babies would have started crying. So I just remember lying there just going, I just need to leave home so I can have a bath when I come back from a gig. That was my entire ambition. It wasn't sex and drugs and rock and roll. I just wanted to have a bath.
A room of one's own.
Yes.
Again,
a bath of one's own. Yeah. Exactly. An old suite of one's own. That was the dream. Yeah, being able to go to the toilet when you wanted and not having to join some kind of queuing system. Mm. And also my family had this thing that you had to read on the toilet. We were all big readers. So you had to, before you went to the toilet, you would have to find your book. So they'd just be like, kind of, someone would be, have their hand on the door of the toilet going, I've reserved that toilet, but they'd be rifling through the bookcase next to the toilet going, but I need to find a book, I can't poo without a book. And you'd be like, just take Robinson Crusoe, just hurry up, come on, I'm on a schedule here. And they'd be like, no, I've read Robinson Crusoe, where's Little House on the Prairie? And you'd just be standing there for 10 minutes.
Did you just have one loo?
Yes.
Blimey.
I know.
One loo amongst 10 people.
Yeah, it was brutal. It really
sounds
unpleasant.
In a way almost like your childhood was a bit like a long lockdown all the time then, if you're all at home all the time and that's what you're doing.
Well, that was I got so many columns out of my childhood at the beginning of lockdown because like homeschooling,
like, I know this.
Done that, yeah, being locked down. So like if you're in a very small, it's a 3-bedroom council house in Wolverhampton. So we had, in the end, we had one kid had the dining room, one child was under the stairs next to the gas meter with a towel, with a curtain across the front of it. I've said towel because we used the curtain as a towel because it was right next to the kitchen. So he'd be lying in bed trying to be private and we'd just go, just gonna use your curtain as a towel, Eddie, and wipe our hands on it. It was just a disease curtain. And but you learn things like the landing can be a fabulous room of its own if you're pushed enough and you don't have enough space. You can like go, I'm on the landing's mine now for 20 minutes. I'm going to enjoy this fabulous space on my own. Lying face down on the floor and crying and looking under the sofa, you will find beautiful formations of dust and mouldy fruits that have been there for ages. And it's like, if you've been locked at home for a long time and not gone out, like looking over a beautiful coral reef. You can try and find the magic in dust and sort of mouldy fruits under the sofa. It feels like I've gone on holiday. That was fabulous and refreshing. Thank you.
So when you had your babies, what was going on in your work? Were you always sort of determined to keep working? Did your parents work when you were growing up?
No, they were both disabled.
Okay.
So my dad's got osteoarthritis. He used to be a fighter. He was in a band who were almost famous, and he always thought they would be famous again. So all of our childhood was him. He had written 5 songs in 1978, and he would re-record them every 2 years in whatever the most fashionable genre of the time was. So we had baggy versions, acid house versions, versions that were clearly inspired by Sting, of these same 8 songs.
Wow.
And every 2 years he'd send them off to all the record companies in London. And my job, because I'd got a calligraphy pen for Christmas, was to write Island Records, kind of the record, the address on the jiffy bag, and send it off. And then 6 months later, he'd get all the rejection notes. Yeah. But we always thought he was going to be famous again. We'd leave this council house and we'd live in a fabulous house by the seaside, to the point where I carefully learnt the names of all of Bob Geldof's children, because I absolutely presumed that within a year we would have moved to London and I would be at school with Bob Geldof's children and they would be my friends. Like, it was, that was how absolutely certain everyone in the family was that it would happen.
Yeah.
And it never did. So by the time I was 13, it was very obvious that that wasn't going to happen. So I was like, well, I will have to make money.
Yeah.
So that was when I started writing, when I was 13.
But I suppose the writing wasn't necessarily about just making money. It was like an escape and a place you could go that was always your space.
And control, like I'd have. Yeah. And also the first stuff I wrote was about sort of our family and stuff. And like when everybody's got an opinion about what the family is and everybody's opinion is different, you're like, well, if I write it down, then that means I've won.
Yeah.
That's kind of what storytelling feels like. Kind of my version will be the truthful version.
Yeah.
And
I will
win. So yeah, it was a way of sort of finding space and having control and being able to sort of be on your own for a bit. Also, at the point where I started writing a novel, I could say to my mum, I can't load the dishwasher because I'm writing a novel.
Mm.
And she had to accept that. So that was another big dick move there.
So when you had your kids, was it sort of being columnists? It's before you...
So I had two. Yeah, so I was. Yeah, so I'd written the book when I was 16. I'd been a music journalist for a bit at Melody Maker. And then I got a column in the Times when I was 18, which I now know was quite unusual. But at the time, I just faxed them a column and went, hi. And they went, would you like a column? And I said, yes. And it was only like 10 years later when someone was asking me how I got into the industry that I told them this story, and they went, that's not usually how it works. And I was like, oh yeah, no, you're right, that is quite unusual. So that was very lucky. And so yeah, I was a columnist at the Times doing 2 columns a week. So that was easy to fit in. I had a week off after I had the first kid, and I don't think I had any time off after the second one because I could just breastfeed. Tits are really flexible, particularly if you've got shit tits. If you've got perfect, lovely tits, they're not that flexible, so you will have to have the kid in front of you. But if you've got knackered old kind of spaniel ear tits, which I've always had, you can bend them round corners. They're quite hose-like, so I can kind of tuck the baby.
Sure, they're not hose-like.
Oh, they really are. They're incredibly flexible. They're extendable. So you can just tuck the baby under an arm, sort of dog leg the tit back round into its mouth, and then just type over its head with a laptop. So that was, I gave, you know, if you think your tits are shit, you haven't yet found their purpose.
I do agree that with breastfeeding, it's like an amazing way to be able to do that and multitask on something else. So
especially
I've done all sorts with that as well.
Especially if you get those baby Bjorn, I got these for my brother when he got his kid, those baby Bjorn carriers that are the most minimal and brilliant. You can strap them in facing you and just plug them into a tit. So you can go shopping, and the only time it goes wrong is if someone comes over and goes, what a lovely baby.
I know, and then they realise you're feeding.
Yes.
And they get repelled backwards, like
literally like a force field. Like,
yeah. I know, that happened to me when Mickey was little, not that long ago, and it was like, wow, that was really powerful.
I know, really.
Just on the pavement, they kind of came over like, ooh.
Yeah. Literally like they're being pulled backwards on wheels. Like, I withdraw.
Yeah.
That was private.
I didn't mean to look. when you're writing those, surely you need to be able to have that space. But what happens when you've got, little ones wanting you all the time? I mean, you've written so much about feminism. Did that kind of go alongside becoming a mum, or is that something that was born out from before that, or is it?
I became a feminist watching my parents because they were incredibly sexist. So there was 8 of us, 5 girls and 3 boys. And the legend is that they only had so many children because they just wanted a boy. So the first 3 kids were girls. Then they had my brother. But by that point, they'd got 3 girls. And they were like, well, he will be swamped by these girls, so we need to make him a brother. Then they had another 2 girls. And then they finally got a second boy, and then the last one was just, I don't know, just like last bang on the drum. And there was definitely a distinction between girl jobs and boy jobs. Like, girls did the cooking, the cleaning, the looking after the kids, like sort of everything. And the boys just had to empty the bins, which is such an easy job.
Yeah, that is.
It's just a DOS job. It's not a job. It's just a thing you do. And my fury at the age of 11 observing this, I was just like, and I didn't know what feminism was, I'd never heard of it, but I was just like, this is, boys and girls are being treated differently, and that is incorrect. We have the same DNA, we're in the same house, we're in the same century, we have the same parents, but boys are being treated differently from girls. This is incorrect. So when I found Germaine Greer and she explained what feminism was, because my dad, when he would mention feminism, well, basically if my mum ever proffered an opinion or criticised him, he'd go, all right, Germaine Greer, pipe down. So my presumption was that feminism was just my mum being an arse. And when I found out that it was slightly more complicated and useful than that, I was like, this is useful. Like, this is a good idea. This is good for me. And in terms of writing, even though I had kids, I'm really lucky, because if you grow up in a house of chaos, just having 2 kids and just having to think about 2 things a week to write is a cinch. Like, I think the main mistake that most writers make is that they sit down to write, but they're also thinking at the same time. You don't sit down and think, you already know what you want to write, you've been thinking about it all week.
Yeah, so it percolates, doesn't it?
Yes. And when you sit down to write, you're literally just describing the idea.
Yeah.
And that's where so many people go wrong. They sit down, they're like, right, now I'm going to write something.
Yeah.
What am I going to write? Well, you're never going to write something. It's impossible to think and type at the same time, I think.
No.
So know what you're going to write and then sit down and write it.
Well, I think that's the beauty of the way a brain works, actually, as well, is that if you care about something, it is just sort of formulating all the time. And I've really learned to trust that process. Like, no, just let it do its thing. And by the time I come to do that scary thing or that important thing, I've probably done more prep than I realise.
Well, there's a brilliant study on this. They were talking about, so I learned about it when you're writing fiction and you're creating characters, and in the sort of brain modelling, they call it golleming. So you could probably imagine, if your mum was here, what she'd say. Like, you can sort of imagine what she'd be saying. You could write dialogue for her if you had to. You've got your mum in your head. And it's the same when you create characters. You create a character until you know what they would say. And that's actually, it's not a conscious part of your brain that does that. It's your subconscious. You create these, you know, you've got all your friends in your head, the people you know in your head, and you know how they react. And when you create fictional characters, they, after a while, are free of your conscious thought. They're percolating away in your subconscious. Because you talk to fiction writers all the time and they go, yeah, I had these characters, and around about chapter 5, they started doing all this weird stuff that I didn't know about. And that is, your subconscious has gone and created them, and you're not conscious of it at all. You can actually create people in your head.
That's very exciting.
Yeah, so this is amazing, because then it also ties in very strongly with mental illness. It's sort of schizophrenics and psychotics who hear voices. that's just what their brain's doing, but they've processed it in a different way. And there's amazing cases of mathematicians in the 18th century who couldn't consciously solve problems, but they would talk to other people they had in their heads who would solve these theorems for them. And like they consciously could not do this. It was parts of maths that they didn't know about. Wow. But the subconscious golems that they'd set up in their head had been doing all this work subconsciously and could then present them with the solution. So your subconscious is incredibly powerful.
Yes.
And if you just tell your subconscious to do something, as you were saying, like on Thursday, I'm going to have to do this thing that I'm a bit scared about. Subconscious, work on this for the next few days. By the time you get to Thursday, your subconscious has gone, well, I've thought about it all. I know what to do. Here's what we're doing now.
Yeah.
So talking to your head's a really important thing. Have conversations with yourself. Your head is an army.
Yeah.
And I think as a woman, you get very used to just telling different parts of your brain, okay, you're going to work on that. We need to have a solution by Thursday. Mm. On Saturday, we're doing this. So work out what the best way is to do that. And you get to Saturday and your brain's like, worked it all out. Here you go.
Since I was little, I actually do talk to myself as well, which I think that probably is the other person, the column-y person.
It's so important. Do you talk to your future self as well?
No, I don't think I talk to my future. That would probably be quite handy.
It's so useful.
I don't know if I have a future self.
And this is really important. This is the big advice that I give to all women. Talk to your future self.
Oh,
because your future, if you start talking to your future self, it starts saying to you, well, like when I started talking to my future self, I was like, where are you? How old are you? My future self. I'm 60. I was like, where are you? She was like, I'm living in Wales. I'm really skinny and tough and I'm carrying a sheep around on my back. And like kind of, and I can identify 60 different kinds of bats and I grow all my own veg. I was like, okay. So now I know that's where I'm heading towards. I liked her. She got on with me. She was very happy there. And I was like, okay, well, that's where I'm walking towards then. That's what's happening. Like kind of.
Oh, I like that idea very much.
It's very useful. It's really nice. You sort of just before you go to bed, 10 minutes before you fall asleep, just like imagine your future self. It's really interesting.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to try that. I don't think I spend enough time thinking about future things like that at all.
Well, you've got five very big reasons to be in the present.
I think when you've got little ones as well, it's very the pace of life is quite fast and you don't really have a lot of time to think too much about the here and now, let alone the what may be.
And that's really, when your kids are little, you have to be very present. But like, that's the thing, again, I'm just obsessed with middle age, at the point where your kids start becoming independent, there's this very common thing of women going, well, you know, that whole emptiness thing.
Mm.
And so many women get into a depression, don't know what to do. But if you've been talking to your future self's sitting there going, the minute the last one leaves, this is what we're doing, here's the plan.
Yeah.
And you start looking forward to it, you don't have this thing of like being kind of shell-shocked and like, I'd never planned what I was going to do when the kids left.
Yeah.
Because you haven't been talking to your future self. But if you're talking to your future self's like, it's ace. They've gone. Well, you've got all your spare time. It's amazing.
You're kind of getting there a little bit sooner than a lot of people, though, because presumably when you had your first baby, not a lot of your peers were having
babies. I was the youngest by 10 years.
So you're kind of slightly ahead of the curve if you're already thinking like that, because your kids are leaving home, but your friends have probably still got kids.
Yeah, they've all got
single
little ones. I've become middle-aged earlier than you normally would, which I'm kind of enjoying. It's great. It means I get to write the book before everybody else gets there and kind of like give them the advice before they hit it.
And do your girls read your writing? And
no one wants to read a book where their mum's talking about masturbating.
I've had to read my mum's sex scenes in her books. It's really,
how was that?
There was one phrase that just I can't get away from, where it says something like, he pegged her like wet washing, and I can't. The book's really good. Don't be off by that. But it's like, it just
for a daughter to read that.
Yeah,
is
it's
different.
Pretty.
All other readers can enjoy that sexy scene, but has it ruined washing for you? Can you peg out washing? Do you feel aroused when you peg out washing? Do you think about your mum and you're aroused when you peg out washing? How dark does this get?
I just decided to stop pegging washing. I don't want to confront any of this.
Mum, I've bought a tumble dryer. It's nothing personal.
I spoke to future me and she doesn't want to look at it either.
It has
6-year-old me. I'm still not pegging out washing.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry? Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
Never happened. Pegs are ruined. It's kind of annoying because obviously I wrote a lot about the difficult teenage years in my books, and they're sort of teenage girls were my special subject for about 10 years. So when the girls started going through problems that I'd written about in books, I'd start giving them advice, and then I'd go, well, I've tackled this kind of more eloquently on page 122 of How to Build a Girl. You might want to read that. And they'd be like, no. And I tested them on the fifth book. The dedication is, it says to my two girls, if you read this, come to me and I will tell you the PIN number of my credit card and you can buy whatever you want. And that was published in 2017 and they've still not come to me. So that's absolute proof they're not reading this stuff.
That's like, brilliant.
My little test was like, yep, they're still not come true on that one.
And how do you find having teenagers? Because teenagers get quite a bad rap, I think, but...
Oh, God, I just think this... I mean, there's stuff that our generation's had to learn, just stuff about intersectionality, racism, sexism, homophobia, kind of LGBT issues and stuff, that, like, if you were brought up as a good liberal, you were like, no, I get these things, I'm not a baddie, I'm on your side, like, I want to help with these things. But we've had to learn so much of it.
Yeah.
Whereas they just have it in their bones.
Yes,
like, kind of,
I agree.
That conversation has been there from day one, so, like, kind of, they will be teaching me stuff that I'm like, but I'm a liberal, I don't need to be taught this stuff. And they're like, no, this is... how we talk about these things now, this is how you need to look at these things, which has been really useful. And they're just so good and hardworking and anxious, and like their lives look so difficult ahead of them. Like, I'm so on their side. I don't understand this whole ragging on the younger generation. Like, kind of, they're just, you know, I'm always on the side of teenagers anyway. Like, kind of, for women particularly, it's interesting because whatever the problems are of teenage girls in any decade, it tells you what the problems are that feminism need to address. Because if you're transitioning from a generally genderless child to a full-grown adult woman, the things that teenage girls find difficult or are scared of tells you what the problems are of being an adult woman now. And we don't at the moment make being a full-grown woman look like an appealing job. And if you look at the instances of mental health and self-harm and eating disorders and things where girls are trying to remain childlike and not become adult women, that tells you there's something very toxic about being an adult woman, which you can observe everywhere. Like, there's no woman in the world that hasn't come in for massive backlash and criticism and cancellation at some point. However good you are, whatever you try to do, you know, you will have been then regretted by the right for being fat or strident or a bitch or unsympathetic, and by the left for not being progressive enough or making a mistake or kind of, you know, not sort of addressing everything all the time. And so, you know, there's no... recently I was writing a column and I was trying to think of a woman who everyone loves and agrees is great and has a happy life and is just kind of your goals. I can't think of anyone. There's no shorthand for a woman that just, you know, there's no female David Attenborough where you just go, everyone loves him, he's great. You wouldn't criticise David Attenborough, would be sad when he dies. There's no one like that, other than the Queen, who I think doesn't count because you just inherit your job. That tells us there's something wrong about sort of, you know, these are the works of feminism that I sort of apply myself to, because girls, being an adult woman is amazing.
You
know, it's hard, but it's incredible. I wouldn't want to be a boy, I wouldn't want to be a man. So one of the things we need to do is go, how do we make teenage girls not be scared to become women, to want to join our ranks, to want to do these things, to join the fight, to have their joy? So these are the things that I sort of think we need to tackle at the moment, because otherwise it just isn't fun to be a teenage girl.
Yeah. No, I think there's a lot to unpick, really, because, I mean, even the fact that feminism is still a thing is so disappointing.
Right.
You know, that's been the dialogue since I was a teenager, and it's still the same sort of conversation, really.
Although you see things progress. I was thinking about you yesterday, because I knew you were coming today, and just thinking about some of the shit that you got when you first got famous. I remember I interviewed you at the time, and like...
Yeah, you were my first actual interview.
Was I? Really?
Yeah.
How was I? Was I gentle and kind?
We had lots of fun. We tried to steal champagne from a bar. Do you remember that?
That sounds about right.
Yeah. No, I remember having fun. It was really fun. But yeah, it's crazy. And there's actually been a few things that have kind of mirrored, because... you got introduced to what you do for a living now when you were 16 and started working at Melody Maker. And at 16, I met a Melody Maker journalist who introduced me to the guy I started a band with. So I think we were both kind of have a similar start into the...
We were in the same place. And I just remember some of the stuff that was written about you, like kind of... they would go on about the shape of your head.
Oh, all the time.
Rhombus head.
Yeah, they'd said that people at school called me Rhombus Face. I'd never had a nickname at school. It wasn't true, but it didn't matter that it wasn't true because it had been written... I think, you know, a bloke. And then they thought that was really funny. So that just went on and on.
And you were a 16-year-old girl being bullied for the shape of your face. And like, and it was because you were just staggeringly beautiful and they didn't know how to cope with it.
Very generous, but it's definitely not true.
It is true. Like, kind of like, we know the people who were being written about in the music press generally. They were just blokes in anoraks. Oh, like, you were this beautiful, clever, so funny 16-year-old girl. And they were just, it was bullying, like, kind of, it was really unpleasant. And you wouldn't get that now.
Or I don't if you think, did, actually, you're right. I don't think you would.
Or if you did, there are so many feminist blogs and so many female writers now, anyway,
yeah, call
that
it out.
Who would call you, have that called out, and they would defend you. And
yeah.
You would, you've got an army. As a woman, there are still so many things that feminism needs to do. But because feminism, it's not an official thing. I keep explaining this to people who don't sort of maybe get it. Like, feminism isn't an official thing. There's no god of feminism. There's no books, there's no rules.
Doesn't carry a card or anything.
It's an idea we all had, and we all chip in.
Yeah.
And like now, because of social media, which has many bad sides, but the good side is, if anything bad happens to a woman, there are millions of women who'll step forward and go, no, don't do this. Look at what you're doing here. Question yourself. I will defend her. But it was the you know, I was just thinking about those times and how difficult it was, because the film that I've done, How to Build a Girl That's Out, is about when I was a teenage music journalist and I joined the dark side for a bit. I turned up like, hurrah for music. I'm a fan. And then I was told that it was gauche to be a fan. Like, that's not how you should write about music. We're here to destroy people and to take the piss.
It was very much the tone of the time, though, wasn't it?
So
all writing
dark.
Was like, it was awful, like, really brutal.
But it was bullying. I look back now, like, bands would be chosen, and, like, kind of, depending, if you were one of the bands that was chosen as a lesser band,
then,
you could be brutal.
Yeah.
You could, like, a band like Ned's Atomic Dustbin, you could be as horrible as you want. The Levellers. Like,
well, I know that, like, with, actually, in the thing I saw where you interviewed yourself, you talked about, but probably one of your lower points of writing, where you said you did, you pretended you did a sort of eulogy at Ned's Atomic Dustman's funeral.
I was the priest throwing
as poo. A review.
Yeah, as the review of the album.
I mean, it's really funny.
I didn't even listen to the
I'm
album.
I'm glad I'm not in Ned's Atomic Dustman.
In those days, you didn't even have to listen to the record to review it. So I just, it was just like, you just write 800 words on Ned's Atomic Dustman. I pretended I was the priest at their funeral. I was throwing earth onto their dead faces, just going, well, what a waste your life was. Mm. Why did you even bother?
Sorry.
I know.
It's so familiar, though, as a tone, because at that time as well, the music press were really, really cruel. They were the people that were supposed to be the fans picking you up, but that was the place where it was like, coming at you with knives.
Totally.
And then for looking outwards for being a young woman, it was the time of things like the Girly Show and all the lads mags and all this kind of thing, where to be empowered, it was supposed to be showing your boobs for blokes and being totally cool with it. And if you're going to be equal to boys, it was being equal to the sort of lad side of boys,
yes.
Drinking loads of pints.
Well, you became a ladette.
A ladette,
which is,
yeah.
In terms of language, is incredibly interesting. So if you were a girl that wanted to drink and have sex and go and have fun and tell jokes, there was no word for a girl who was like that. They had to take a boy word and call you ladette. Like, those were not seen as female attributes.
No.
You were becoming male to do
exactly.
that. And just the restriction of that when you're a teenager. And also, I remember very much the sort of persona that I constructed was, I was a swashbuckling dame. I was a broad. Because if I'd gone in there as the innocent 16-year-old in pigtails that I was, I would have got crushed. And I knew that on some subconscious level. But you know, if you present as like, I was a virgin when I started at Melody Maker, but I turned up as this kind of sexually knowing kind of like dame.
But that was really the mood at the time as well. I mean, I would do exactly the same thing at 16, of just like, I was reading More magazine and I was like, this is where I'm supposed to be heading, you know.
Yes.
I'm supposed to know about all these positions and be extraordinary at all that stuff, because that means I'll be respected or whatever, or score points or whatever.
It was
supposed
almost
to be.
Like a I can remember watching Twin Peaks, and there's the scene where Sherilyn Fenn
ties a cherry stalk in a knot with her
and thumb. I was like, that's all, I'll have to know how to do that.
It's
I will.
Quite easy. Have you
it's
had a go?
So easy. I've got a piece of piss. Yeah. But like, she's auditioning to be first. Okay, let's break this scene down. First of all, she's auditioning to be a prostitute at the local brothel. The fact that this astonishingly beautiful teenage girl would have to audition, I don't think there's like, how rigorous, you don't need a rigorous testing process here. She will get custom. It's fine. Sherilyn Fenn isn't on some kind of like refusals list.
No.
She's not on the subs bench. And secondly, every girl I know thought, that's a thing I'll have to learn.
Yeah.
At some point, someone will want me to tie a cherry stalk in a knot with my tongue, and my career and my future life, maybe my marriage, will depend on this. And like, you know, the lists of all the blowjob techniques that you have to learn and all this kind of stuff, and you will have to have anal sex and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And you're just like, this seems like a very big to-do list. How about just a snuggle? Like,
But I think I was doing exactly the same thing of trying to build that armour, and I was really quite brittle about things and very black and white, and I love that, and that's rubbish, and if you like that band, you're an idiot. And I remember I had to grow out of so much stuff and so many ways of being. When people say... Now, I met you when you were 18. I'm waiting for them to say, and you were horrible.
Yes, totally.
So I feel like I must have been pretty horrible.
But what you have to do, and it's a really common thing, like, so the whole notion of cool is, you know, leather jacket, shades, cigarette, monosyllabic, like, yeah, no, like, kind of, it's cynicism. Like,
yeah.
I've seen it all. I've seen the world. You can't shock me. And that is something you do when you're very innocent and inexperienced, and you put on the armour of cynicism to make yourself seem worldly. And for a certain amount of time, that will be useful to you because it does protect you to a certain extent.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I've seen everything. You can't impress me. Leave me alone. But there comes a point very quickly where the armour just becomes like a cage. You are trapped in it. You can't grow in it. And you can't dance in it. You can't be joyful. You can't you can't have the balls to just go, I like this.
No.
I'm a fan. I had to keep it secret for 3 years that I loved Crowded House more than any other band when I was at Melody Maker. And that was finally how I met my husband, because we were both on a tube one night and he went, can I tell you a big secret? And in the 90s, if a man was going to tell you a secret, it could get quite dark. And I was like, yeah, all right, go on. He went, I really like Crowded House. And I went, I do too.
Aww.
And he was like, should we go home and watch the live DVD? I was like, yeah. And now we're married. But that was like, those were the big secrets that you kept, that you loved beautiful things, that you were a fan, that you were an enthusiast.
But it's such a relief, isn't it, when you let go of all that and you realise that being cool is so overrated and not even a real thing, actually.
Oh, it's a very thin, cheap, unpleasant experience being cool. Like, it doesn't lead to anything.
No.
Like, kind of, you don't meet friends being cool. You know, you don't have the best nights out of your life being cool. All the best nights of your life are where you're just a joyful idiot. Just kind of
true.
Just talking and dancing and singing and falling over and going, let's steal a boat.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's so true. It's such an important change that happens. And you're so relieved when you're out the other side of it, actually. And then I think when you have teenagers, you just have to, it's not the same, but you have to let them do all the same sort of arc in their own way. Because it's still part of what growing up is all about.
Well, you really need to have grown out of being cool by the time you get teenagers. Because I thought, I'm like, well, I'm a clever, can-do lady. I understand a lot about psychology and stuff. So when my kids are teenagers and they have problems, I'm going to be a cool mum, not a cool mum, but a cool mum. I'm going to get this shit. I'm going to help them out. We're going to have these great talks. That is not what your teenagers want. They want you to be just a lovely idiot. You just need to be a fluffy, like a lovely dairy cow called Daisy. And you just need to moo at them. Like, if they come to you with a problem and you're like, well, do this and do that. No. They'll get angry with you. They'll be just like, you just think I'm stupid. You're always telling me what to do. You ruined my life. And you're like, but you came to me with a problem and I gave you a solution. Surely that was what was happening here. And they're too young to understand it. They're just like, I hate you. And they slam the door.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas when they come to you with a problem and you turn all of your brain off and going, oh, that sounds shit. Oh, I see you're really upset. What are you going to do, Bab? Then they start coming up with solutions.
Mm.
But you have to just pretend to be stupid. Like, when they come up with a solution, you're like, that's so clever, I never thought of that. Moo. And just trundle off again. And they're like, oh, Mum's such a lovable idiot. And you're like, I'm not. I'm so clever, I pretended to be stupid.
I wonder if that role's easier with women anyway, because we're not as bothered about, I don't know, the shift of being from a sort of younger man to a dad man. I think for us, it's maybe you're not shrugging as much yourself off if you say, I'm not cool.
Yes, no, totally. Yeah, I mean, it's hard. I mean, once you've pushed a baby out, you can't really ever pretend you're cool again. It's not a cool experience.
Like, no.
Kind of, you're just, I was mooing through that as well. They told me to be quiet. I was doing my moos. Yeah, they were like,
you're allowed to be noisy.
They were like, you're putting, apparently my moo was very penetrating. I was putting off other women in other wards from my mooing. They were like, shh. So,
and did you find it hard when you were sort of, you know, raising a family to how your, you know, desires feminist to sort of weave those things together? Because there's a lot of very traditional expectations, even now, I think, on the roles that are at home.
I'm enormously lucky in that my husband was the first proper feminist that I met.
Mm.
Like, he wrote a piece about, remember in the 90s, back to the 90s, but remember in the 90s, like, everybody had Brazilians. It was like, it was that sort of, that was the sort of first boom of online porn, so everybody had to be waxed.
Mm.
And he wrote a piece for Time Out, he has a columnist there, and about just sort of like, why? Like, kind of, let's just talk about how great pubic hair can be, like, kind of save yourself some money, pop. And it was hugely controversial at the time.
Yeah.
Like, kind of, no one was talking about that. It was all just lads. And that was the first time I thought, oh my God, this is interesting. Like, talking about why we think women should be a certain way and questioning it is really, really useful. Look at the fuss that it's caused. I like this.
Yeah.
So I'm very lucky that I've got a feminist who's just as interested in cooking and cleaning and kind of running a tight household. He's got all these little systems. We argue about how to best load the dishwasher, but that's universal
that's
in every
normal.
Family.
That's normal. Yeah.
So there's no point in putting a pan in a dishwasher, because in the space a pan takes up in a dishwasher, you could put 10 plates.
Mm.
pan takes 1 second to wash. Just wash the pan and put 10 plates in there. That's saving you time.
Mm.
That's a battle that's raged for 20 years. That's like, that's, he's not ceding on that.
Well, weirdly, I go from both sides of it. Sometimes I'm the one who washes out the pan, and other times I'd rather put the, you know, the pan, the dishwasher, and just be lazy.
What, if it's a crusty pan? What kind of pan are we talking?
If it's really quite, I quite like the fact that the dishwasher will make it all the crustiness soften, and then I can clean it easily.
Yes, now that is true. I saw you.
I use it as a sort of deep soak type thing.
Yes.
Mm.
And it is satisfying to just, I mean, it is like a cupboard that you put all your problems in and you walk away from it. Like, there is something very beautiful about it. But yeah, there does, I think, if the government are ever going to do anything, they do need to, if they put out official guidelines for loading a dishwasher.
Yeah, it'd be helpful.
It would be down to every family to disagree with them. But at least you'd have a base point where you go, well, this is what science has said. I need science to say this. British science needs to lead the way and actually tell you how you should load a dishwasher.
Do you think you would be a different kind of household if you were raising boys?
I think about this a lot. I think.
It's an interesting one, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because I think about it too. Obviously, I've only got one gender as well.
Well, I observed that when the kids were younger, all the mums with girls had an easier time because girls would just go off and play on their own with their dollies and they'll just play together. Whereas boys have to be taken out. You have to do things with them.
Yeah, it's like having dogs or something.
So I also observed that all the mums that had girls would generally, the mums that had boys would be thinner than the mums with girls because they just have to be out playing football with them. The mums with boys had jeans and they would go and play football with them even if they hated it. The mums with girls could wear a dress, put on a stone and just watch them playing games. And I was like, I'm glad I have girls. But when you get to teenage years, I think that's where you have to do the spade work with girls because it's so complicated being a girl. Boys are like dogs, girls are like cats. So boys just come home and they're like, well, I just played football with my friends and blah, blah, blah. Girls will come back and go, Stacey said this and then Honey said that and Kitty's having a party, she hasn't invited me but her other friends invited me, and then I heard like kind of Polly slagging off someone else, and then there's this whole thing here, and then Blossom sent me a DM but I don't know what it means, and it's this spider's web of girl intrigue and hurt and status and secrets and sort of working out who you are that is a full-time job for the first couple of years.
Complicated.
It's really hard because to work out how to be a girl, and this is why most of my books are called How to Be a Woman, How to Build a Girl, it's such an act of construction to be a woman in a way that boys, I think, it is a lesser act. So those years are intense. A friend of mine quit her job at the Times when her kids hit the teenage years, and my kids are still really young, and I was like, why are you quitting? And she was like, well, that's where it gets hard with the teenage years. And I was like, don't tell me that, I'm in potty training, I thought the teenage years were easy, they can make their own breakfast, surely that's where it gets good. And she's like, no, that's where you have to be there.
I agree, actually.
They come home, and if they can't tell you then why they're upset, they will just bury it for 2 weeks and it becomes a problem. You've just got to be there all the time with teenagers.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And they think they don't want you, but they need you a lot.
They really do, yeah.
And it's like, for my teenager, like bringing him down from his room and spending time with him and just making it so that he... I sort of have to keep checking in on him, really. Because if he left it to his end, he'd just be in his room all the time and I could probably not really see him except to, like, put some food around the door or something.
Yeah, slice of ham under the door.
Exactly.
With eat this written on in a Sharpie. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
That you have to be around. And also the thing that you have to learn is saying, like, what are you thinking? That will make a teenager angry often because they often don't know what they're thinking.
No, I know.
Just feel something.
Yeah.
And to talk about emotions, you can't often have a head-on conversation. You need to be off doing something together.
Exactly.
You need to go for a drive. You need to be doing some gardening together or cooking together. And then they can just, while they're busy with something else, they can talk about how they feel. But asking them what they think, it often ends really badly because they don't know and they get angry and they're really aware. I think it's so unfair that as a teenager, you know that your parents are older than you and know more stuff than you because you know that they're constantly looking at you and kind of pitting you a bit and sort of going, yeah, I remember being young and confused like you, like kind of, the imbalance is really unfair. It's very difficult to negotiate. So you need to be doing something where you feel equal.
Yes.
You need to be doing a thing together so that they feel equal and they can talk about their feelings.
And I think you're right about not always feeling you need to solve every problem. Sometimes things just need to be aired and talked about and let them say how they feel and just sort of going, acknowledging that that's hard rather than actually going, well, what can we do and how can we solve that and let's book you into this and do that.
And the biggest mistake I made in my teenage parenting of teenagers was, I come from a family where if you have a problem, you either solve it straight away or you just ignore the feelings and you just make a joke and you sing. That you just, you jolly yourself out of your mood. You just don't have moods because there was no room to have moods with that amount of children in the house. And I kept trying to jolly my kids out of their moods and that became really destructive. I was scared of them being sad. I didn't want them to be sad. I was like, I will make a joke. We will do something. We'll go somewhere. I'll buy you a thing. Don't be sad. And that's the signal to a child is, well, my sadness is scary. like, kind of, I can't talk about it. My sadness needs to be a secret, and that's where it can go really, really wrong. So it took me a while to learn to not be scared of sadness, which I was. And to sit and go, you're sad, I'm not scared of it, sit here, tell me how you feel, you can cry, you can be angry, you can be angry with me, it's fine, I'm not scared, I'm just here. But that was a difficult year learning that. That was something I hadn't read anywhere, so put all that in the new book as well. Don't be scared of sadness.
Yeah.
Sit with your kids when they're sad and go, it's fine.
But then also the way that things are talked about keeps changing, because now the sort of advice for parents about those things is to say, there's nothing wrong with the feeling, acknowledge the feeling, it's the behaviour you can change, but the feeling's right. But I don't think that was always...
No.
You know, things keep changing, don't they?
About... Was there any psychology when we were growing up? Like, it
No, I don't think so. No, I don't feel like there was when we were around tonight, when we were little.
No.
And I mean, I think there's also, I don't know if you do this as well, but when I learn something new about raising the kids, I'll think, oh no, I've been getting it wrong all this time, and why didn't I try that? And it's like a constantly evolving, reactive thing.
Well, by the time they're raising their kids, I'm sure our understanding of psychology will be so much greater than it is now.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
That's just the way that human beings work. Yeah, there's so many things that we still don't understand, and that they will understand, and we will seem like primitive people.
Yeah, I know.
And I'm quite looking forward to just being able to sort of finally hand it over to a younger generation and go, yep, you are totally wiser than me. You crack on. I'm going to sit here and knit and cackle. Looking forward to my hag years where I just sit there knitting, surrounded by chickens going
yeah, with the sheep on your back.
And with the sheep on my back, and my chickens around me. Yes.
the thing I want to ask you is how do you think you encourage feminist boys? Because obviously in my house I'm the only example of a woman they have.
Yes.
And sometimes my reaction normally is to be really very, very capable. I think, well, if they see that I'm very strong and very capable, that's a great example of a woman in their life. But then I think, but actually, maybe that just will make them think that when I'm always the one that can solve everything, and
yes,
they can just sort of loll about and not tidy up the mess or do any more than taking the bins out.
So I've written, when I wrote How to Be a Woman and then became Britain's fourth most famous feminist in North London for 2011 only, whenever I would do live shows, the third question I would get asked in any Q&A was, but what about men? What about boys? And I'd be like, I'm all about women. I am team tits. I have just spent 10 years thinking about this. Like, I just, about men?
They'll figure it out.
It would be the ultimate irony of feminism, would it not? If having sorted out women, women then had to sort out men. Like, they would just have to sort this out themselves. But the more I've thought about it, like, the core definition of feminism is believing in the social, personal, political, and economic equality of the sexes.
Yeah.
And once you, and obviously my first thing was like, okay, how are women unequal within this? But there are ways that men are unequal in gender as well. Mm. So because that's the patriarchy, it's like about gender roles.
Yeah.
So, and feminism has tackled the inequalities of women. So I went on Twitter 2 years ago and just went, lovely men of Twitter, like, kind of, we're always talking about the problems that women have. What about the problems that men have? And I thought it'd be like a couple of hours and be sort of fairly interesting. It went on for a week.
Wow.
I got tens of thousands of replies. It became a news story in newspapers across the world, because what was uncovered was that the gender inequalities that, particularly for the younger generation, so you hear men saying things like, feminism's gone too far, it's easier to be a young woman than it is to be a young man now, women are doing better in education, women do better in employment. And they're right. I think it is easier to be a woman because we invented feminism. We've invented this network that allows that whatever problem you have, you can go out there and talk about it and women will help you.
Mm.
Men have not invented this network. They don't talk about their problems. So when they were asked this, it was the first time they talked about it. So they'll talk about things like, some of them were just seemed silly, but you're like, oh no, that's interesting. They're like, I can't dress sexy for my girlfriend or wife. Like, my wife can like put on something really beautiful and I know she's in the mood and it makes me fancy her. But if I want to look attractive for my wife, what can I do?
Mm.
All there is like those comedy posing pouches from Anne Summers that say like, beware the beast, or it's like of an elephant. And at first I was like, lol, 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 that's quite funny.
Yeah.
But then it was like, if you flip reversed it and like the only, if Anne Summers was selling things for women that just made your genitals seem amusing or like a beast, we'd be horrified, right? Like, kind of like, that's just, I mean, to be honest, I would quite like it if my pants said beast on it. But still, it's about the variety of stuff. So men can't make themselves attractive. Like, kind of, they would talk about the clothes, just going, it's so boring to be a man. Everything you wear is like grey or beige or black. Like, kind of, women, I know that it can often be a burden for a woman to open up her wardrobe and go, who have I got to be today?
Yeah.
But we can choose from a variety, we can be a different person every day of the week. Like, today we're businesslike, today we're like a lovely mum, today it's a picnic, today we're a beautiful dairy maid, today we're glamorous. Men just open the wardrobe every day and it's like, I'm Simon, I will put on some trousers.
Yeah.
Which I think is why they're so into fancy dress parties. Like, it's the only chance they get to express themselves and experiment with being someone else.
Yeah.
There's a stasis to being a man, whereas a woman gets to be a million different things.
Yeah.
And that's grating for a man. Then it got really sad. It was, the men were saying things like, If I'm out in a playground and I see a child fall over and hurt itself, I can't go and help it because men are threatening. I will have to look around and find a woman. Another man going, there was a 13-year-old girl got locked out of her house and she was walking up and down my street crying. I couldn't go and help her. I had to get my girlfriend because men are threatening. And then you think about this if you're a boy. Like, when you're a boy child, you can go and help another child.
Mm.
As soon as you get to 13, 14, your voice breaks, you get a bit taller. And then you throw colour into it as well, if you're black or brown. You're suddenly a threat.
Yeah.
To be seen as a weapon. Like, kind of, and humans want to help each other. That is absolutely innate, being a human. But boys can't do that. They're seen as a threat. And I suddenly realise, well, there is such a thing as female privilege. Because whatever the things I fear in life, I know no one's ever been scared of me.
No, I know that my 16-year-old thinks about that a lot. He's not the sort of traditional football-playing boy. He's quite sensitive and empathetic. And he's not into those, like, the sporty, all the sort of traditional boy things. Is not really where he found himself. And he really struggles a lot with that idea of the sort of toxic masculinity and being seen as a threat. He's had it where, you know, old women have said on the bus, you know, are you supposed to be out, and hoodies and all this kind of thing. And he's found it really unnerving.
And that's just a terrible thing to tell a human being. Like, kind of like, that's, you know, that crushes a part of your spirit. And so you're saying toxic masculinity. So many people misunderstand the phrases toxic masculinity or the patriarchy. They think it means all men. They're like, kind of, you're saying all men are toxic. To be a man is toxic.
No, not at all.
It's the aspects of what you're supposed to be as a man that are crushing you as much as the ideas of what a woman is supposed to be are crushing us.
Exactly.
And what you need to do. And so all these things that men were listing, I sort of looked at them and it was like, these are all the things that you, that are making your life difficult, are ways that you're supposed to be a man. And the solution to all of these is to take female attributes, to be able to talk about your emotions, to be able to dress up, to be able to help, to be seen as gentle and non-caring. Women have taken all the things of men that we want. That's how we've become more powerful in the last century. We wear trousers, we can talk about sex, we have jobs, we get education, you know, we're in space, we can rule countries. We have taken all the male attributes that we thought were powerful and desirable. Men have not taken any of the female attributes of being, you know, the main carer for children, to be able to express yourself, to be able to help people. And the reason they've done that is because women are still seen as lesser. We could take the male things because that made us more powerful. Men don't want to come and take the female things because, like, we're the losers still.
Yeah.
And that's why when men say feminism has gone too far, it's like, well, no, it can't, because every time women succeed more and are loved more and more powerful and successful, and we raise the whole image of women, the more easy it's going to be for you to take these female attributes that you so desperately desire and that are making you unhappy, the things that you say are ruining your life. So feminism can never go too far. Every time a woman succeeds, you're raising the stock of women and allowing men to be able to go, I'd like to be like, you know, for men to be able to say, my big hero is Beyonce, my big hero is Michelle Obama, my hero is Greta Thunberg.
Yeah.
Every time you say that, you're saving men who can take those attributes and put them in their lives and not be crushed by this toxic masculinity. So I ended up writing, I thought at the beginning of it, another book about feminism, but more than half of it's about men now, just kind of the way we raise boys, where we fail in that, where society fails in that, what would make men happier. Because if feminism is about equality between the sexes, you've got to do both. Feminism is only doing half the job if it only addresses women. And you know, women shouldn't have to do that, only do it if you've got the time. But that is something very urgent now.
Yeah.
And I think we need to be able to show men how to do that, because I don't think they know how to do it.
Well, I think this is something that hopefully more and more people will realise about anything that's always coming up in as a sort of social conversation, whether it be about homophobia or racism or the importance of feminism. It's the conversation has to have two places. It's not enough to go, well, that's brilliant, those feminists over there doing their thing. Brilliant.
Totally.
All of us make the change or it doesn't really work.
And you can't hide it. And that's why sort of like there's a sort of there are the more the sort of angry and more niche feminists who are like, you know, a man can't say he's a feminist, or like kind of you need to know that you have to do all these things to be a feminist. You can't hide the feminism in a tiny place. Like, you can't hide it in a place that only the cool people can get to it, or the people who know all the rules. This is an idea that is for everyone and is about everyone. So you can't put all these strictures and rules to it and hide it and go, well, you can only talk about feminism if you know these things or you are this person. It has to be for everyone. It only works if we all do it. Like, kind of, there's no point in 10% of the people being brilliant, perfect, strident feminists and them telling no one else is a proper feminist.
Yeah.
Feminism only works if everybody believes in it.
Exactly.
There's no point in you being a strident feminist but 90% of the world thinking that feminism is rubbish and that women can't do stuff.
Yeah.
You have to spread it. You've got to spread this brilliant, joyful idea. The good news is that women are amazing and we can help men.
Yes.
Tell as many people as you can. That's the rumour this week. Feminism's amazing. Tell as many people as you can.
Well, I suppose that is something that's changed a lot since we were teenagers, that now it's definitely not seen in the same way, feminism, is it?
Well, I remember, were you around for Riot Girl? Were you a little bit too young for that? The sort of punky Riot Girl thing? So Courtney Love and Hole and stuff. Because at the time, that was the big sort of feminist movement, and it was all, it was Kathleen,
that was basically
Hannah,
just
Bikini
as I started going out probably around.
So you would have seen the fashion effects of it. So it would be girls in like 90s and Doc Martens.
I did one of my first gigs in a slip. Yeah, right. That was a real look at the time, wasn't it? Now I'm like, I actually still own it, and I'm like, I can't believe I went out in that. Like,
but you
whoa.
Could get dressed for a night out for 50p. Charity shop.
Yeah.
Petticoat, done.
Yeah, I know.
And easy to wash, and you can crinkle it up and fit it in a handbag. But that was, that feminism then, everyone was going, well, if you're a feminist, you should be into Riot Girl. But they only wrote about it in fanzines that you could only get from cool record shops in Seattle. And it was like, well, this is a brilliant movement, and there's some great music coming out of it, but you can't hide the feminism in a fanzine. Like, kind of, you've got to put it in the press. Like, the girls who really need this are on horrible council estates in Wolverhampton.
Mm.
They're not going to go and buy your fanzine in Seattle.
No.
Like, you know, spread the news, man. Let everybody in. So yeah, that's why populist feminism, I think, is the only feminism that works, really. You just got to spread that news.
You have. It's funny, because when I was doing this, the idea of the podcast, I was thinking, you know, I want to speak to working women who are also raising a family about the balance. And then people have said to me sometimes, oh, wouldn't it be interesting to talk to, are you going to do some dads as well? And I was like, no, I think it does have to be women, because if you speak to a same-sex couple, it's two men, the chances are that the conversation that might be asked of them is about who's the mum role and the dad role. There'll be an option, as if they've had to, you know, be able to make choices. And obviously, that doesn't mean they're not being judged. There's definitely a conversation to be had. But when it comes to this and talking about working mothers, it's quite specific, I think.
Totally. And it's so inculcated. Like, there's another chapter that I've written in the book. It's like, why? When my teenage brother came to live with me, and I thought before he moved in that he would be helping around the house, because that's what I'd done as a teenager. Like, we had two kids, he'd be helping me in the housework, and he didn't. He just played his Xbox, and he's really good at maths, and that's what he was doing. And I was like, why is he not helping? And then I was like, okay, now I get it. Like, when it was a boyfriend or a husband, I didn't get it, because I wasn't there for their childhood. I was there for his childhood. I had women's magazines next to my bed, and women's magazines are full of tips about everything. How to run a household, how to raise a child, how to campaign against FGM, how to give a blowjob, how to get stains out of a curtain, literally everything. And the women's magazines are in a section that's called Women's Lifestyle. You are taught in these magazines that cover everything how to have a life with style, high standards, how to buy the best sofa, how to buy the best coat hangers. Men, their section in the magazine shops is men's interests, and all their magazines will be about one thing. It's about music or fishing or gaming or maths or anything. And then, so men are encouraged from day one. There's no general interest magazine for a teenage boy where you learn about how to run a house and have sex and talk to people and campaign. You just get your gaming magazine or your fishing magazine, and you just learn one thing.
Yeah.
And so, like, when my teenage brother came to live with me, I was like, well, I can't understand his maths when he's talking about it. I don't see it. I don't understand that system. That's what he's learned. He doesn't see the system of this house. It's equally a different system. He doesn't see how a kitchen gets tidy, how a child is taught to say please and thank you, kind of, you know, how we would buy new blinds, like, kind of why the lighting in this front room is really nice, because we don't turn on the big overhead light. We just use the nice side lamps. Women have been taught to see that and notice that and run a household from day one to be good at everything.
Yeah.
Men are taught to specialise from day one in one thing, and that's how they succeed. So they literally don't see it.
Yeah.
And then when a heterosexual man and woman move in together, women are like, now we'll make a fabulous house.
Yeah.
Whereas the man would be like, I will get a good chair that I can game in, and I will have an amazing stereo and a brilliant record collection, and I'll learn how to cook a curry. And it's just a different thing. And that's where the clash comes, like, kind of like two people who've been raised in completely different systems with completely different ways of saying the world, and they can't see the value in what you're doing at all, because they've never been taught it.
Yeah.
And that's what the clash is. And the only solution is to have a massive whiteboard in the kitchen, where when you're walking around the house seeing all these things, you just write down what needs doing on a whiteboard, and you go, split them in half, so I don't have to think about it, because otherwise you are just walking around all the time with a massive to-do list in your head.
Now,
for instance, in your house, do you have the stairs system?
Yes, of course.
Things at the bottom of the stairs need to be taken to the top.
Yeah.
Does anyone else in your house get that system?
No. I think you tweeted about this, actually, and I was like, no, that doesn't happen at all. And people just walk straight past it. But I never go up or downstairs without something in my hands.
Literally this.
There's always something that needs to go somewhere.
Literally this.
Yeah.
But I will watch children and men step over this pile of stuff.
Or Richard puts things in the middle of the stairs as well, which is really annoying. That's just dangerous.
That's a trip hazard.
Yes.
Health and safety needs to be in there.
No, I like the stair system.
It works, right?
I grew up with a stair
system. But it works for us.
that.
We know that, but no one else sees it.
It's invisible.
It's like ultraviolet light. So much of what gets done in the house, we've got UV goggles on and we see what needs doing.
Like
there was a handle broken off the door in the dining room, and like kind of I was like, I'm not going to do anything about it. Just sitting there getting angrier and angrier. Okay, it's 6 months now. It's no one noticed. You had to put a knife in the hole and turn it to open the door because the handle had fallen off.
And people just went on with that for months.
I was like, but this is a thing that could be solved, and I refused to do it.
Yeah.
In the end, obviously, we had a huge row, and he went off and mended it. But, like, that's the UV goggles.
Yeah.
I'm raised to go around going, you know, all... Like, when you've got kids, you're thinking in the future. You're walking down a street with a kid, and you know there's a dog that barks at number 19, and your kid is scared of it, so you cross the road here.
Yeah.
And you know that in half an hour they'll be hungry, so you've got a snack with you, and you've got a spare set of
clothes. All of that stuff.
You're living in the future. You're constantly scanning, like... Yeah. The whole stitching time saves nine thing is a woman's thing. You go, that's a problem now.
Mm-hmm.
And if I solve it now, it will be five times less expensive than if I solve it in 6 months' time.
Mm-hmm.
You're not taught to scan a life like that as a boy. And that's the big difference.
That's
why you mustn't be capable in the house, basically, Sophie, is what I'm saying. Because you're scanning. While you're scanning all that, they're not going to see it.
Mm.
You need to put the goggles on them.
Well, that's what I like as well about when I have these conversations. Is I turn my phone off and I'm just gone. And like last week when I sort of came back to doing my chats, and when I turned my phone back on, someone had asked a question about which kid needs to go to school. And I was like, you just had to figure it out because I was here and my phone was off. And that's nice.
Every woman I know has this fantasy that they will... This was pre-COVID, to be fair, when hospitals became scary and dangerous. But before COVID-19 happened, every middle-aged woman I know has had the fantasy of having to go to hospital for a week.
Yeah.
Not for anything serious.
No,
maybe just like a really clean break on a leg where you just had to be in hospital for a week. They wouldn't let you use phones because it interfered with the scanners. They'd bring you food on a tray and you'd just lie there for a week and do nothing. Like every middle-aged woman I know, like more than going on a spa weekend, just a week in hospital with a broken leg, that'd be amazing.
Well, I recently fell off my bike and I hit my head, and I had like 3 or 4 days of... being at home sort of in my pyjamas and taking it easy, and I watched A Place in the Sun, and it was honestly one of my like favourite afternoons of the whole of the last 3 months. I just watched people walking around little apartments in Portugal and thinking about whether they'd buy it, and they were all pretty ugly apartments, and I just loved it so much. I was so happy.
I'm escaped to the country. I'm like,
okay, some sort of vibe.
I'm very specialist now. Only Wales, Herefordshire and Gloucestershire. I'm not interested anywhere else.
Well, that's where your future you lives. You
exactly.
You've got to start getting your eye in.
Scanning, right? And it's great when it's an episode from like 10 years ago and they're being a bit fussy. It's like a house for £230,000. They're going, it's not very big. And I'm like, I'm from the future. You will get fuck all for £230,000 in the future.
Yeah.
Buy it now. That's an investment.
Yeah.
Don't be so fussy, Jan. Buy that house.
What do you think you would think of you as a mum, like pre-baby you? What would you think? Would you be happy
what I thought
with your
I'd
mothering?
Be like? Mm. Yeah, no, I think I would be very impressed. I mean, I just presumed that I would keep working, that my kids would be. The main thing I wanted was for my kids to be funny. I think that just takes you a long way, like kind of.
Definitely.
Because funny is hugely underrated in many ways, because funny means that you've got cleverness left over to play.
I think being funny is brilliant. And I'm always unnerved by serious children, I have to say.
It's so weird, isn't it? I mean, God bless them, and I respect them, and they'll probably go on and rule the world.
I know, but I'm sort of glad they're doing that with their kids so that my kids can be daft.
Totally. Gets you so far. And also, like, when you're talking about serious things, if you can be funny, you're far more likely to make your point. If
Definitely.
You can make it, like, it's one thing I keep telling sort of young people on the internet, like, when they're really passionate about a subject or like an injustice and they're angry about it, and I'm like, if you tweet and communicate in anger, people just hear the emotion and they're going to come back at you with anger. No one's going to listen to what you're saying. And you are quite right to be really fucked off about racism or homophobia or sexism, but all that's going to happen is people are going to hear your anger and they're going to come back at you with anger, and you're going to get burnt and unhappy.
Yeah.
If you can make your point with some kind of humour,
first
of all, people will respond with humour and you have a great conversation and you make friends. And secondly, people retweet it if you're funny.
Yeah.
Like, it will spread further. You will spread your information.
Definitely.
Hidden within your joke is the information you wish to spread.
Mm.
That's how you spread it. Observe in nature how trees reproduce. They make delicious fruits with the seeds hidden inside, and then the bird takes the delicious fruit and shits out the seed somewhere else. That's what humour is. It's the juicy apple around the seed of your truth that the birds of the internet will shit across the country if you hide it in delicious fruits.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes I've realised it's funny because every family has their sort of own atmosphere and things that have been brought out and the things that get celebrated. In our house, being funny or doing silly dances or songs is always the thing that gets attention.
Yes.
So
it's a real performer's house.
Yeah, and so sometimes, you know, you you're very keen to have kids, aren't you, where they're like, oh, it's so great how you're confident and bold, and yeah, you do question things, and every once in a while you're like, oh my god, they've all got bloody opinions and they're all like jazz hands about stuff, and calm down, get down off that table. And
also, the worst bit about raising funny kids is the agonizing 6 months to a year where kids are learning to be funny and they know the rhythm of a joke,
yes,
but they don't understand how jokes work. So they would be like, knock knock, who's there? Pasta who? Pasta flushed down the toilet.
Yeah.
Yes. You're like, okay, it's the rhythm of a joke. You've understood the format of the joke, but you've not understood
it's not actually
the
got
purpose
joke
of the
in
joke.
It.
Yes. And like, but you have to laugh.
Yeah.
And that was that for me, that was the hardest of all the illnesses and everything that's ever happened. The 6 months where they're learning to be funny was the hardest bit of parenthood. Fake laughter. Just, I'm not very good at fake laughter. I'd be like, they'd be like, you didn't find that funny, did you, Mum? No, I definitely did. You didn't, did you, Mum? No, I didn't. Learn to be funny.
I'm trying to think. Well, I think the hardest bit I've found, well, certainly recently, is that when they get very sort of fixated on talking about something. And so a lot of my work over the time, or projects I would call it rather than work during lockdown, and trying to get things done, would have one of them sort of circling constantly with a sort of dialogue, and then do you know they're going to do this, and then this character did that, and do you know this, and it would just seem to be going on and on and on, and I'd be thinking, I don't know what we're talking about. And at the end I'd sort of be like, so was this all something you dreamt? They go, no, I said it was a film or something. And I'm like, oh god, stop, just stop talking to me about
then
you don't want to crush them, but
no,
please, I'm not interested.
But there does come a point you are like, I will have to crush you a bit now. You do feel like a mother lion just putting its paw on a
trust
tiny
me,
head.
This is fascinating, but can you just go out the door and shut it on your way out, please?
Try zooming grandma.
Yeah.
She has time. Yeah. She will be fascinated by this.
Like when I was watching the YouTube thing I was telling you about where you were interviewing yourself.
Yeah.
At the same time, my four-year-old sat next to me going, Mummy, try and guess what chocolate I bought today that we haven't had for a really long time. It's round. You have to try and guess it. And he wouldn't start going on. It wasn't a roller. It wasn't buttons. It turned out to be a Tunnock's tea cake. And at the end of the bed, my eight-year-old was dressing in a mermaid's tail and white gloves and asking me about the lines and the gloves and if that still meant he could be a magician. And I was trying to watch this talk you were giving and I was like, this is completely untenable.
I
think the room of one's own idea is a really good idea. I fantasize about that. Have to be a hospital bed. I just settle for a little corner somewhere.
I think if you ever have to explain motherhood to someone, I was like, what I've wanted to do, and they're 16 and 19 now, is just in one day open up a note on my iPhone and write down everything they asked me, everything I had to do from them, and everything they said at me. Every time I had to respond to them in some way, every time I was interrupted, just do it as one list for one day, just so I could finally work out where my day had gone. And the thing is that you're so busy dealing with that shit,
you don't have time to write that list. Yeah.
And that, if you want to know how busy you are as a parent, that is it, that you don't have time to write down why you're so busy.
No.
And you get to the end of every day and you're just like, why have I not done half the things I was going to do?
Yeah.
And often you can't remember. It's like, all I remember is just there just being this miasma of bullshit from about 6:30.
That's probably why you got so into your gardening, because then it's like a proper, it had a shape to the task, and then it happened.
And things get completed. And the brilliant thing about a garden is like, one of the great things about getting older is you have a real understanding of time. Like you can stand there in March and go, if I plant that now in September, that corner's going to look amazing. And that's incredibly satisfying. Whereas it's so much longer with kids. You plant an idea here about them being a good person, and then you have to wait till 2025 for it to seed. Whereas in a garden, within the space of a year, everything that you want is satisfied. And it's... And also, they hate gardening, so it's the one place I can... If they come out and they bother me, I'm like, I will talk to you about this, but can you help me double-dig this border? And they disappear again. It's like, right, you can sort it out on your own.
They can. Oh, well, it's been so nice talking to you. Do you remember that chat when you were interviewing yourself? I know I keep banging on about it, but it did make me laugh out loud.
I can't remember anything. I can remember the horror 10 minutes before I went on stage, because I was already thinking, he's going to have to spoon-feed me through this one, because I am so ill.
No, you managed to talk for, like, I think it's an hour. When you asked yourself if you were good in bed, you said, I'm really good in bed. I'm a really good lay. Except for one time where you'd said, give it some welly. You said we had to stop and just look down at where the good sex had been and just leave it there.
Oh, it was so... I've written about this in the book as well. I've written like... You realise when you've been in a relationship for a long time that when you say, I love you, it means loads of different things. Mm. Like, you can say, if I say, I love you when I'm hungover, it means, I hope I wasn't a disgrace last night, do you still love me? And when you ring someone from a hotel and go, I love you, you want them to say, what you mean is, I want you to say, you're working so hard and we miss you. Like, I love you very rarely means I love you.
Mm.
And the most difficult I love you to decode is when you're having sex. Because I will equally say I love you when I want him to come straight away. I'm done, this is it, we're finished. Or, this is amazing, carry on forever. It's so difficult and dangerous to say I love you during sex. It could mean one of a million things. It's just best not to say it. So then I substituted give it some welly.
And give it some welly's good.
I can tell anybody who's listening that if they're thinking of saying that during sex, it's not. Yeah. It's not useful.
It's not. It's about as sexy as the little.
It will end.
Pants that look like an elephant.
Yeah, leather. The beast inside. If you want the sex to stop, if you're having chafing issues, like kind of, and you want the sex to stop, just say give it some welly. It will
give
end.
Give it some welly. My podcast is called Spinning Plates.
Is it on every platform?
It is on every platform,
is
Kit.
Is it on YouTube?
Oh, actually, I don't know if it is on YouTube. You can find it on things like Spotify, Acast, Apple things. Are you thinking of having a listen, Kit?
Yeah.
Oh, thanks. That is Kit, my 10-year-old. Oh, no, you're not 10, are you, Kit? You're 11.
What are you doing now?
I'm just recording the outro. Yeah. I realised in my intro to the interview with Catelyn, I forgot to say that the noise in the background was Kit listening to some clips on YouTube just before bedtime. So, yeah, we're both sat in the bedroom, aren't we, Kit?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just Kit and I and the cat Rizzo. She's quite old now.
What platforms have I got downloaded?
I'll show you in a minute, Kit. Kit seems to suddenly be very keen to get access to my podcast. He's very interested in what working mothers think about life. Anyway, thank you for listening. I hope you enjoy the chat with Catelyn. I think something she said actually really, I think is very true, where she said that through humour, you can get people to listen to you. And if there's ever an example of that, it's Catelyn, isn't there? I mean, she's always someone where as a writer or as a reader, she's really grabbed my attention. And I've pressed her book, How to Be a Woman, into the hands of many of my friends as a sort of birthday present or Christmas present. If you haven't read it, read it. And I can't wait to read More Than a Woman, which is out in September. And she's also got a movie coming out at the moment too. So lots and lots of things happening in Camp Moran. Oh, and her daughter has brought out her first ever single as well that she recorded during lockdown, and her other daughter did the video for it. And I'll find a clever way to do a link to that, because it's a really beautiful song. So, yeah, lots of exciting things, lots of creativity. What a clever artistic family. Anywho, back to saying thank you to you. Thanks for listening. I'll see you again next week. And lots of love in the meantime. And as Kit was asking, yeah, you can find my podcast everywhere. You found it. Clever you. All the best. Bye.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.